Hello, and welcome to Not Another Science podcast, brought to you by Edinburgh University Science Media. I'm Kelsey.
And I'm Katie.
And today, we are joined by Geomagnetism PhD student Frederick Dahl Madsen in the School of Geosciences here at the University of Edinburgh. And he'll be telling us all about the science of auroras, also known as the Northern Lights.
If you're like me and becoming increasingly jealous of more and more people seeing the Northern Lights in Scotland and the UK these last few winters, then this episode's for you. Freddie's got all the tips on how to maximise your chances of seeing them.
Plus, we learned how they form, what they have to do with the Earth's magnetic field, and why the sun is just as important for a good space weather day as it is down here on Earth.
But before we start, this podcast is sponsored by Griner Bio One, manufacturers and direct suppliers of laboratory and medical products to academia, research, pharmaceutical, biotechnology and healthcare organisations globally. For details of their extensive product range, visit www.gbo.com.
We hope you enjoy learning all about the Northern Lights and get some great tips on seeing them for yourself.
And now over to Frederick.
I am a geomagnetist. I study the Earth's magnetic field. I am a PhD student at the University of Edinburgh, and I've always been really interested in magnetism and found out when I went to university that particularly the Earth's magnetism, I think, is super interesting. There's a lot we don't know about it, but we are very dependent on it every day, on many scales, on small scales. Like if you're using your phone and you want to figure out where you are on Google Maps, your phone has the geomagnetic field in the phone and it measures the magnetic field where you are. And that's how it knows that you are in Edinburgh or in Newcastle or wherever. But also we use it to be protected by the large amount of dangerous radiation coming from the sun. So every day we're very thankful for the magnetic field.
It's cool that the Earth is a giant magnet.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
So can you like briefly say what geomagnetism is and then maybe talk about the most famous version of geomagnetism, which is the aurora?
Well, yeah, so the Earth is a giant magnet. So geomagnetism is the magnetic field or the study of the Earth's magnetic field. So if you ever in school played around with magnets and you looked at what the magnetic field lines coming out of a bar magnet looked like, that is roughly what the Earth's magnetic field looks like. You got a North Pole and a South Pole. Now, that's 90% of the magnetic field, but then there's, as in most parts of science, there's the rest of the 10% that then makes it really complicated. And so that's the whole study of geomagnetism. In the field of geomagnetism, we got two groups. We got the people who look down into the Earth and try to figure out where the geomagnetic field is created. And then we got the people who are looking up from Earth and are looking at how the geomagnetic field is affected by the sun. And that's where you start to see aurora and northern lights and southern lights, where you get an interaction between the sun's magnetic field and the Earth's magnetic field.
That's really cool. So the aurora is caused by the particles coming from the sun. Is that what it is?
Auroras are caused by activity in the sun, but solar flares are not very conducive to causing big aurora that we observe. So what you see is a solar flare is like a very sharp spike of really narrow energetic particles, or narrow in the sense that there's a very narrow wave of them coming out from the sun, and they don't really ring the Earth's magnetic field enough to cause aurora. But they're usually also coming with what we call coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, and they come from sunspots. And so if you imagine that the sun is like a face of a teenager full of spots, and then sometimes these spots pop, and they pop and they release loads of highly energized matter and particles out into space. That comes out in a direction from the sun, and sometimes that direction is towards the Earth. And what I said before with the Earth looking like a bar magnet, if you remember back to your science lessons, that is very symmetric. It goes up at north and south, and then it comes the same way on each side. But the Earth's magnetic field is shaped by the sun, so actually it looks more like a tadpole, where the magnetic side of the magnetic field that faces the sun is kind of pushed in towards the Earth, and the side of the magnetic field that faces away from the sun kind of dragged away. And so when these sun, when these coronal mass ejections hit the Earth, then it rings the magnetic field like a bell. And then some of that highly energized matter and particles get into the Earth's magnetic field at the poles, the geomagnetic poles, because that's where your field lines are kind of open and branch out into space. And that's where it then comes in. So that's why you see aurora towards the north and south pole.
That's so cool.
Okay. So the like presence of aurora is kind of dependent on whether or not like one of these spots is exploding on the sun, essentially.
Kind of. So explosions happen on the sun all the time. So you quite often see northern lights or southern lights, just because there's always like an influx of particles. But when these spots happen and you get a solar storm, is when you get more than usual. And so the charged particles travel further south. And I think I should also touch upon what the aurora actually is, because we think of the aurora as these like big colorful curtains. But they aren't actually the charged particles. It's the Earth's atmosphere that we see that is getting energized by those charged particles. So the charged particles go in and they bump into all sorts of molecules and atoms we got in the atmosphere, and we've got a lot of oxygen and we got a lot of nitrogen. So the colors we associate with the aurora are usually green and purple. And green is what you get when atmospheric oxygen absorbs too much energy in their electron shells, and the electrons energize and then they release energy when the electrons then relax, and that energy corresponds to the color green. So we see green. If you got a lot of particles coming in from the sun, you can then end up getting the energy travel even further down into the atmosphere, and then you hit nitrogen, and nitrogen will either emit a blue or a red color, which then usually combines to purple. So that's where the aurora is actually, you can see the magnetic field lines, because that's where the particles travel along that then energize the atmosphere.
That's so cool.
So for example, if we have like climate change increasing the number of different elements, I guess, in the atmosphere, would that change the color of the aurora in any way?
I mean, it probably would and it wouldn't, because the amount of particles you have would change, but the particles that you have are the same. There's just more or fewer of them.
It's probably like tiny percentages as well, right?
Yeah, because the other thing is that when you're atmospheric molecules are energized, that increase in energy would have to then not be disturbed for the molecule to release light.
Okay.
So that's why you have like a lower limit in altitude of where you see the aurora, because if you're too close to the surface of the Earth, the molecules bump together and then that light's not released. So you can also get like a lower estimate of where it is, because you need quite a sparse atmosphere for aurora to happen.
Would you be able to see auroras from other planets? Like if this is happening from the sun, would other planets get an aurora? And could it be a different color if they had a different composition of gases and particles in their atmosphere?
Absolutely. So people are starting to see aurora on Mars, which is quite interesting because Mars doesn't really have a dipolar, so the north-south magnetic field that we got on Earth, because Mars doesn't have a existing dynamo in its core to create a magnetic field on Mars. But you still do see aurora, because it's just the charged particles from space coming in and energizing the atmosphere. And although Mars doesn't have much of an atmosphere, there's still a little bit left. You get loads of auroral activity on Saturn and Jupiter. And Jupiter's magnetic field is huge.
Okay.
So there's a lot of very strong field lines for the charged particles to travel along.
So would they look quite different to what it looks like from Earth? Or would they probably still be similar? I guess that depends on the atmospheric content.
I think it depends on the atmospheric content and the strength of the magnetic field. So how far they're able to travel, if at all.
Would the strength of the magnetic field create more movement or kind of angles and the sort of dancey sort of motion do you see in videos?
I think the dancey motions you see in videos are somewhat due to winds moving it as well.
Yeah.
So there's lots of factors playing in.
So you're saying the best aurora is on Jupiter, essentially.
Yeah, but there's no surface of Jupiter to stand on to watch it.
Yeah, that's the only issue.
So we're not endorsing moving to Jupiter to see the best aurora.
Maybe Jeff Bezos can go in the future.
We could send Jeff Bezos just to check.
Yeah.
So you said that the magnetic field is protecting us from these charged particles. Are they actually dangerous? How important is it that the Earth is protected?
It's quite important, not so much due to the charged particles themselves, but what they would do to the Earth over a long period of time. So the magnetic field shields us from most of the solar wind. And the solar wind is just tiny and big explosions happening on the sun, being emitted out into space. That's why we call it a solar storm if there's a big explosion, because it's a stronger wind coming. Exactly, lots of wind. But what that would do to a planet without a magnetic field is that it would slowly take some of the atmosphere with it. So it would kind of erode the Earth of its atmosphere over time if we didn't have a magnetic field to protect the atmosphere. That's what's happened on Mars. That's why Mars doesn't have an atmosphere, because it doesn't have a magnetic field. So whatever atmosphere that used to be on Mars has been eroded away by the sun.
So it's actually very important that we have one, because the atmosphere keeps us alive.
Exactly.
Perfect.
The solar storms can be dangerous to astronauts. Mm. So if there's a big solar storm, they get into the wee lead costumes and go hide in one of the rooms on the space station. And you do have the Earth's magnetic field kind of has a hole over the Atlantic called the South Atlantic Anomaly. And another thing that space weather is really damaging to is satellites. So you can see every time a satellite travels over the South Atlantic, it stops working for a while because there's less protection from the sun over this region.
Interesting. So kind of want to make sure everything's within the magnetic field to make sure that no one's getting hurt by these charged particles.
Exactly. We want to keep the geomagnetic field.
Okay. So you've spoken about like a solar wind. Is that kind of what defines space weather, I guess, in our galaxy? Basically what the sun does is what all the other planets follow, or is anything else kind of affecting weather in space, I guess?
Yeah, no, so you get all these, one of the things that often confuse me in sort of geoscience and astrophysics is you get all these different spheres and they're all within one another. So we've got the atmosphere that's got all the gases, and that's within the magnetosphere, which is everything inside the Earth's magnetic field. And then you also got a sphere that describes where the sun's magnetic field is protecting us from everywhere else.
Okay.
And so space weather is, as you're saying, Kelsey, is mostly due to the stuff coming out from the sun, because every other magnetized sort of damage that would come from space would kind of be stopped at the edge of the sphere that describes the edge of the solar magnetic field.
Interesting. So if you left the sun's protective circle, you'd be out in the wild. You wouldn't know.
Well, we don't know. There's a satellite heading there that's been going for some 20 odd years. So it's quite far away. I imagine you'd probably be hit by something else, but we don't know for sure.
Cool. We'll find out soon.
Yeah. Watch this space.
So we had a few questions from our listeners via our Instagram. And Ellie, USI president, is asking, how are the Northern Lights different to the Southern Lights? Or are they different?
So the lights themselves aren't different. However, the regions around where you would see them are. So we see a lot of northern lights because there's a lot of landmass towards where the aurora is, the aurora borealis. But the aurora australis happens mostly over the southern Pacific or southern Atlantic. So there's not a lot of places you can see them. except for during strong solar storms where you can see aurora closer to the equator, so further south if you're in the northern hemisphere and further north if you're in the southern hemisphere, as well as there's a region of the magnetic field where you're more likely to see aurora than not, and the magnetic field changes over time, but it doesn't necessarily change in the same way in the north and the south. So the North Pole is doing a lot of moving around, whereas the South Pole is staying quite stable. So the aurora you see are the same, but the magnetic field that moves them around is not.
So it's not like if there was high geomagnetic activity and lots of auroras going on in the Northern Hemisphere, there's not necessarily that happening in the Southern Hemisphere, or is it more like one massive solar storm is going to be visible everywhere, or, well, everywhere that's possible to see auroras?
No, it definitely happens both places at the same time. But if you were able to see it somewhere in the Northern Hemisphere 10 years ago and somewhere in the Southern Hemisphere 10 years ago, during the same solar storm, you might not be equally likely to see them at the same locations again.
Cool. And actually, you might not know this, but you know, I feel like the magnetic field is, it swaps, right?
Yeah.
So will we have a more stable period in the Northern Hemispheres when it does swap? I don't know what it does.
No one knows when it swaps. So you're talking about reversals where north becomes south and south becomes north.
Right.
And there's a lot of discussion about how that actually works and when it's going to happen, if it's already happening. It's a geological process. So it takes 20,000 years for it to happen, which is geologically fast, but in human time scale, it's quite slow. But what will happen is that rather than north and south switching, kind of like moving on a sphere, you would get the North Pole and South Pole getting smaller and smaller in intensity until there was no north and south, and then they would just grow in the opposite way. So north would still be towards the geographic north, with no North Pole where Santa lives, but it would just, the compass would point the other way.
Oh, cool.
Is what the current theory is.
Okay.
But we haven't observed one in high resolution time because they take a long time and all we have is rocks to infer what it might look like.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it, to the poles disappearing.
So is the changing magnetic field something to do with this? Because the fact that we've seen a lot more auroras visible from Scotland in recent years and the UK, whereas before, like, I don't know, I remember kind of even like 5-10 years ago, no one was regularly seeing auroras from Scotland, but they kind of are now. I think Emma on Instagram was also asking, why is 2024 meant to have higher Northern Lights activity? Yeah, is that to do with the magnetic field or the solar activity?
So that's due to the sun. And Emma is totally right that we're predicted to have a peak in aurora activity in 2024. But that's because the sun goes through cycles of activity, and we refer to these as solar cycles. And they're last 11 years where there's a peak in the middle and minimum on each end. And it's a cycle that describes how many sunspots you see on the sun. And so they kind of peak over 5 years, and then we get a year or a few years of really high solar activity, and then it kind of tails off, and then the sun's magnetic field flips, and then it happens again. So whereas the Earth's magnetic field flips over tens of thousands of years, the sun's magnetic field does it every decade or so. And we actually thought, so we thought that, like you were saying, 5-10 years ago, there weren't many, but that's because 5 years ago we were at a solar minimum, so there weren't many aurora to be seen in Scotland. But at the beginning of this solar cycle, all the experts were saying, oh, we're getting into a really quiet cycle, we're not going to see anything, it's going to be really boring. And then already 3 years in, we were already at a higher point than most people had predicted. So it's ending up being quite an interesting one because no one knows exactly how big it's going to be. We can make also sorts of model and try and predict how many sunspots we're going to see. But it's ending up being a way more active cycle than we had predicted, which is why there's so many news articles saying, wow, we saw Northern Lights from Portobello again. Incredible. And there might be even more in 24.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen it in person, but
I think I have seen it. Mm-hmm. But we just had to take a photo. I didn't actually see it.
Yeah, because that's the thing, that it seems like it's easier to see the colours on your phone.
Yeah, but that's because we've got a really romanticised idea of what the aurora is, because we always see pictures of them, and I haven't seen them either. I would love to see them, because I feel like sad. I deserve to see them.
Yeah, that is sad, you do.
Thank you. But if you go somewhere where there's lots of aurora, you'll probably see them really clearly, and they'll probably be really beautiful. But where there's lots of aurora, there's also very low light pollution. So you'll be looking up in the sky, and there'll be no light around you. If you see them from Edinburgh, there's loads of street lights, and there's the Fourth Row Bridge that's full of lights, and there's lights over in the other side of the Firth of Forth. And those lights, your eyes are having to kind of adjust to those lights, as well as a quite faint light that comes from the sky. And if the moon is bright, that's also another light factor coming in. So they're really hard to see. Whereas if you got a camera or you got your phone, you can adjust how much light you want to take in. And you can kind of, if you do really long shutter speed, you take in more light. So you will also take in the faint light signals that are then from the aurora that you wouldn't necessarily be able to see with your naked eye.
Okay. So your suggestion is just increase the shutter speed and then just sit there for a really long time and hopefully get some light into your camera.
Yeah, I'm sure that's how they get the really fancy, bright pictures. But...
yeah, increase the shutter speed. If you can either get down to the sea where there's no light in front of you, or behind a hill that would cover most of the light but you can still see the sky, that would be good. The other problem for everyone doing any sort of geoscience, looking either out or in, as clouds. Mm. Clouds are your main opponent in trying to see the northern lights.
Do you also need to be able to see low in the horizon? Because I don't know, I think my parents have always been looking on aurora watching me, like, can we see an aurora, like years ago when there was no chance. But yes, they'd always say, oh, you need to see like low in the horizon because it's so far north or whatever. But is that right for Scotland or?
Well, it depends on the solar storm.
Right.
In 2003, there was the Halloween storm, which was like a really big solar storm, and you could see aurora down in Florida.
Oh, wow.
In which case, if you were in Edinburgh, you'd want to look south.
Right, yeah.
Or west. But if you can see aurora in Florida, it's probably daytime here.
Mm-hmm.
So if for most of the solar storms we see, they're kind of small to medium. So you would have to look into the horizon because, as you're saying, the Earth is curved because the Earth is round. And so you would see the aurora low down because it happens further north. But if the solar storm is strong enough, you might be able to see it right above you. So you've mentioned Aurora Watch, which is an app made by a group in the University of Lancaster. And that's really good. And that has a, it's free to download, and it has a map of where you're most likely to see aurora. So you can go in and see it, and if that most likely is south of where you are, then you want to look either up or south.
Yeah.
And if it's over where you are, you will want to look higher up rather than close to the horizon.
If there's like a peak area that's going to be like the best place to see it, is that more dependent on the weather, the clouds and stuff, or is that more to do with like where the solar storm is concentrating most?
So it's mostly... mostly symmetric around the Earth. So there's nowhere on Earth that you're more likely to see it than others, with the exception that you're more likely to see them if you're outside a city than if you're inside a city.
Oh, right, yeah.
You're more likely to see them far north. But there's nothing that like guarantees that, oh, you're more likely to see it in Finland than you are in Orkney.
Right, yeah.
Or in Canada. It's just, if you get really lucky and it's darker more times of the year, or it just happens that a lot of storms happen where it's always nighttime. Like, oh, we get really unlucky and all of the solar storms happen in the daytime in Scotland, then you have no chance of seeing it.
Yeah, I just meant if it was south, if the spot on the map on Aurora Watch or whatever said it was south, I was just wondering why that might.
Yeah, no, that depends. So it's just like a... it gets green on the map where you're likely to see it, and that green will move further down the stronger the storm.
Okay, yeah.
But it's usually, if you're north of Aberdeen, you have a higher chance of seeing them.
And you said that there was like these cycles, and you thought that at the beginning of the cycle there's like going to be no activity. Is it quite hard to predict? Is it based on solar activity that you're making these predictions, and is it like quite hard to make these predictions, or is like how much should I trust Aurora Watch basically?
You should trust Aurora Watch, because Aurora Watch is based on measuring the geomagnetic field.
Okay.
So it measures the changes in geomagnetic field right now, which happens when the solar storm hits the Earth. You get a really rapid change, a small one, but a fast one.
Mm-hmm.
And that says, oh, Aurora now.
Okay.
How much should you trust people predicting whether the next solar cycle will be bigger or smaller than the other one? Well, it's the same question as how should you trust a weatherman, except that in the processes that we're studying, it's very much slower processes than the weather. So imagine it's making global climate models, but rather than having 200 years of climate data, you have a month. So you don't have much to go on.
Okay.
And what you have to go on is from the 60s and just, or from the 30s, and it's just like a guy looking up into the sun and damaging his eyes and drawing dots on a page. So because it's a slow process, you can kind of just wait and observe it in real time and make your own predictions. I think some are based on statistics and some are based on like what we call magnetohydrodynamics and models, big dynamo models of the sun. And I imagine that they all just, I'm not a solar physicist, so I don't know, but I imagine they just all put them together and get the best model out and say, this is what we think.
Okay.
So what would you say your best tips are for seeing an aurora? Although I guess if you've not seen any, what are you doing to try and see auroras when you're getting all these alerts in recent times from all this activity?
So it's follow the British Geological Survey, the BGS, Space Weather and Aurora Alert on Twitter or X. They do a good job. They always watch the sun, and then when you get activity from the sun, you got like a day or so to kind of prepare. So they will tell you if you're likely to see something or not. Then get Aurora Watch or a similar app on your phone to tell you now, it's now. And then make sure you have a space where it's going to be dark, and the higher you can get, the better, particularly in latitudes like Edinburgh, where you're wanting to look closer to the horizon. So somewhere dark, somewhere high. It's best in winter because winter is darker, but winter is cold. So get a comfy jacket and your best hot beverage in a thermal cup too. So you might have to wait a little bit.
Lovely.
And a good camera.
Yeah, of course. Nice little blanket.
And a good friend to watch them with.
Yeah.
And we can all be praying for you to see an aurora.
Fingers crossed for Freddie.
That was a really interesting conversation. I don't think I ever really knew much about the Northern Lights, so it was really fun to find out exactly how they're made. I'm excited that they're becoming even more common, and with Freddie's tips, I hope everyone gets to see some in this cycle.
Freddie also mentioned, annoyingly, once we'd stopped recording, that citizen science is really helpful for aurora research. Posting photos or videos of auroras online can help add to data that researchers have on them. So we'd encourage you to share your photos on the internet. Photos of the Northern Lights. I know fewer people are using Twitter these days, but apparently the aurora communities are still pretty strong there, both for alerts and information about sightings, as well as sharing photos and videos. And we've linked some of those sources that Freddie mentioned in the show notes.
Freddie gave an example about the power of citizen science. There was a phenomenon similar to the aurora discovered that appeared as just a thin band of light in the sky. Photos and observations from the public and amateur sky watchers brought it to NASA's attention, and it ended up being named STEVE, which they turned retrospectively into an acronym for Strong Thermal Emission Velocity Enhancement.
So if you happen to see any aurora and strange things happening with lights in the sky, please take a picture and post about it online so researchers can have more perspectives of the aurora.
If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a follow on Spotify or wherever you are listening to this episode, so you don't miss the fab guests we have in the works this season. This podcast is brought to you by Edinburgh University Science Media, bringing you exciting conversations about the science being done by our very own staff and students here at the university and beyond. You can find out more about us and read the latest issue of our magazine at usci.org.uk. That's EUSCI.
We're a student-run society, so any Edinburgh-based students are welcome to get involved in writing, editing, and illustrating for our magazine, as well as being involved in producing this podcast in the future. We're on Instagram at USI Media, Twitter at USI, as well as Facebook and LinkedIn as Edinburgh University Science Media. You can give Freddie a follow as well on Twitter at FDMadsen. Any feedback and suggestions for the podcast are always welcome via our social media or by dropping us an email at usi.podcast@gmail.com.
This episode was hosted by Katie Pickup and me, Kelsey Tetley-Campbell. The podcast logo was designed by Apple Chu, and the podcast episode art was designed by Elizabeth Carmichael. The intro music is an edited version of Funkorama by Kevin MacLeod, and the outro music is an edited version of Footballs in Space by Professor Colin Campbell.
Thank you for listening, and until next time, keep it science.